it's not only our families that we place there. These motels are open to the general public. They can, you know, rent to a walk-in, anybody coming in. And we don't know what that activity looks like, and having children exposed to that can, you know, be very, very concerning.
LA is moving homeless families into motels. They're off the streets, but the challenges continue. We are focusing on homelessness this week, and we'll go out to a motel in the San Fernando Valley in a little bit. First, though, a big victory for President Trump at the Supreme Court today. The court has upheld the administration's travel ban.
Well, I think it's pretty much a final word. It's Supreme Court. You know, we went up and we'd win it, we'd lose it. We just waited for the Supreme Court. Yeah, that's the final word. That's Supreme Court. Now, do I want to go in with a different one and maybe a different variety? I don't think there's any reason. It's a very strong victory.
This is the president's third travel ban. The other two were struck down by lower courts. This one includes seven countries, five of them majority Muslim: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, and two non-Muslim countries, Venezuela and North Korea. Lonnie Chen is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He has advised both Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio's presidential campaigns, and he joins us now to talk about this ruling. Hello.
Hi, good to be with you.
Great to have you. Okay, so the ban had been found to unconstitutionally single out Muslims in previous iterations. So did adding the two non-Muslim countries make it more palatable to this court?
Well, it wasn't just the addition of the two countries, Madeline. It was also the process that the court says the government used essentially to narrow the basis for the travel ban. There was a process undertaken by the Department of Homeland Security in conjunction with the Department of State to identify those countries that would not be able to give the United States reliable information regarding its nationals and potential terrorist ties or other criminal activity. So that process took place over a course of many months, and so the court says that process essentially was sufficient, in addition to the broadening of the ban to non-Muslim countries, to keep it from being struck down by the court.
Right. Okay, so those non-Muslim countries, Venezuela and North Korea, for all intents and purposes, no one from North Korea is trying to come to the United States. They just can't. So it doesn't really mean anything in reality, right?
Right. And in fact, the bans as applied to Venezuela and North Korea weren't even the subject of the lawsuit that made its way to the Supreme Court. Really, the question before the court was the application of the ban with respect to those majority Muslim countries. And I think what the court says is, in essence, if you look at the totality of Muslim majority countries around the world, these bans apply only to a very small percentage of those countries, which is one of the reasons why the court struck down the attempt to bring down the ban on the basis of violation of the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment. So, in fact, the court does address that question and does address that argument. But yes, North Korea is a little bit of a red herring here.
Right, and Venezuela as well, because it does allow for business and tourist visas. It just doesn't allow certain leaders and their families to come to the country.
Correct.
Okay, so basically the court was saying, look, there are, and the administration was arguing, and the court agreed, that there are Muslims from a whole bunch of other countries that aren't included in this ban, such as Indonesia, for example. And so how can this be a Muslim ban if all these other countries aren't included? Right.
Right. Yeah. So in essence, the administration makes the argument that there are tons of places where that's not the case. And also, you know, it makes the argument that there are certain exceptions that the travel ban allows for. For example, in the case of folks from Iran, people are able to still come to the United States on student visas. And so the idea was not to single out a particular religion, but in fact was entirely sort of a national security-based justification for what they ended up doing.
Okay, so if you're a student from Iran and you get a visa, you can come. But let's say you're a grandma who wants to come visit her grandchild here in L.A.
Yeah, now that may be more problematic. Now, again, what this version of the travel ban does, and this is why they asked President Trump about whether he wanted to do another version, because a lot of legal scholars would argue this version of the ban was so narrow, it was really designed to withstand constitutional scrutiny. Now, in each individual case, each individual country, there are restrictions that apply to that country that may not apply to others. So in certain situations, the example you gave of the relative wanting to come visit their student who's in the United States would be permissible. In other cases, it would not be. It just depends on the country at issue.
Okay. So this travel ban has been in effect while the court considered the case. Is it now a permanent ban?
Well, it is a ban that is continuing. So for every 180 days, The federal bureaucracy, in essence, is required to report to the president on whether any of the suspect countries have improved their processes enough to be taken off the ban list. But there is no end date for the ban. In other words, it will continue indefinitely unless revoked by a future administration or unless all of the countries on the ban somehow shape up and they're able to be removed after review.
Did the court assess the vetting techniques on the part of the United States, or did the court just say we have to take the administration's word for it that the vetting is not adequate?
Yeah, you know, the court basically says that there's a tremendous amount of deference that should be given to the executive in determining the application of immigration laws. And one of those elements that deserves deference, according to the court, is the means by which the government determines whether foreign governments are properly sharing information regarding security risks on their nationals. And so the court doesn't go too much into the vetting process specifically, but does say that the government has met its burden of showing that it has a process in place that sufficiently attempts to discern whether, in fact, foreign countries are sharing the necessary information to help us make admission decisions to the United States.
Syria is on this list, so I'm assuming that the small trickle of refugees who were allowed in, that door has now been closed.
Well, there is an exception for refugees. Refugees potentially could still enter the country. The ban itself includes essentially a blanket exception. Now, we don't know, we don't have a great sense of exactly how many people fall into this exception, but there is an exception the ban provides for people who can essentially make a case that they won't be a security threat to the United States, even if they come from one of the restricted countries. There are also specific exemptions with respect to refugees from particular countries as well. But suffice it to say, Syria falls into the same category as North Korea in the sense that we probably don't have a ton of people from those countries trying to enter the United States or being able to enter the U.S. at this time.
Okay, finally, there's a lot of talk online about Korematsu, the case that approved Japanese internment camps during the Second World War. Did the court overturn Korematsu in today's decision?
The court did, actually, and this is quite a significant thing if you're looking at Supreme Court jurisprudence. The court actually says that the Korematsu case was wrongly decided and actually says that the case decision was gravely wrong the day it was decided, and it's been overruled in the court of history, and the court no longer considers it good precedent. So that is a really significant development for people who, for a long time, have felt that Korematsu was a grave violation of justice and a significant dark stain on the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court.
And why would they do that in this decision?
Well, I think for a while now, the court has spoken dismissively of the Korematsu decision, but it had never officially taken the position that that case was no longer a good law for its central holding regarding the permissible removal of U.S. citizens into internment camps during World War II. And so I think the court wanted to make a statement, wanted to tell people that, look, this is a bad decision. It was wrongly decided, and no one should consider it to be the law of the land anymore.
Lan He Chen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, Dahlia Lithwick is here to talk about the other big case decided by the Supreme Court today. It involves California and abortion. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Another significant Supreme Court decision today, a mark in the win column for anti-abortion forces. SCOTUS struck down a Ninth Circuit Court decision on a California law called the Reproductive Fact Act. That 2015 law requires crisis pregnancy centers, which are often faith-based, to inform clients that the state provides free or low-cost abortion services. Justice Clarence Thomas, writing for the majority, said that violates the center's anti-abortion beliefs, therefore their First Amendment rights. For more on this and what the ruling means for how these centers work, we have Dahlia Lithwick now. She covers the courts for Slate. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. Was the court and Thomas worried about freedom of religion or freedom of speech or both when they cited the First Amendment?
So the court did decide it as a speech case, but very much based on the idea that the FACT Act was compelling religious dissenters to use speech that violated their views. So it's a little bit of a murky question, and I think going forward it's going to be a brisk area of litigation.
Then tell us more about what Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote, because he concurred, but it was a separate concurrence.
Yes, Anthony Kennedy joined the court's conservative wing and threw in his lot with Clarence Thomas's majority opinion. But then he went further and did a concurrence that is quite striking. He says the FACT Act was part of California's legacy of forward thinking, and that something about that legacy of forward thinking really affronted him. And he goes on to say, it is not forward thinking to force individuals who profess an ideological view that they oppose. And then he went on to say, it is forward thinking to begin by reading the First Amendment as ratified in 1791 to understand the history of authoritarian government as the founders knew it.
Authoritarian.
Confirm history since then shows how relentless authoritarian regimes are in their attempt to stifle speech. It goes on, Madeline. He's more or less saying that freedom of speech is this central, important right, and the law imperils those liberties. So he is going full on authoritarian talk to describe, in fairness, a law that simply said you should probably post information about what services you do and don't provide.
All right. Now the dissent. What did the dissenting justices say?
Justice Breyer writes a very, very frustrated dissent, and I should add that he really, I think, is trying to track something that has been throughout this case an issue, which is that there are about 12 states that ask doctors to read scripts, and these scripts come with a whole bunch of warnings about the correlation between abortion and suicidal ideation and breast cancer and depression. And even though these have been debunked by the AMA and other medical fact-finding entities, the states still require that physicians have to give these warnings before they administer an abortion. And so I think what Breyer's trying to say is that, look, if the Reproductive FACT Act in California comes down because professionals cannot be compelled to give information they disagree with, then it has to follow that the states that are compelling physicians to give anti-abortion information that they also disagree with, those have to fall as well. Mm. And this is essentially something that he observed at oral argument. He says, what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. The rule of law must embody even-handedness, he says. And so if states can lawfully require doctors to tell women seeking abortions that they can get adoption instead, you have to be able to uphold a law that says to women who are seeking reproductive information that abortion services are available.
And just to be clear, California does not require doctors to provide that erroneous information when before they provide an abortion.
That is correct.
So we were talking about other more conservative states.
Mm-hmm. There are states, and some of these have been challenged, interestingly, based on physicians' rights to free speech. And so I think that one of the things that this case opens up is this whole very murky area of the law that has to do with professional speech and physician speech. And it is really going to be complicated going forward, and Justice Breyer says this in his dissent, to determine what kinds of disclosures and truthful information professionals give that are now going to fall into question. I think his point being that, are we really carving out speech about abortion as a certain type of incredibly different speech that doesn't get regulated the way other medical speech might be?
Because of the religious overtones.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are two aspects to this law. One is that these crisis pregnancy centers need to tell patients that they can seek an abortion elsewhere at low cost provided by the state of California. The other aspect is they need to indicate that they are not licensed, if they're not licensed, that they are not licensed medical providers. Did they address that part in terms of the freedom of speech issue? Because that seems to me just a factual requirement that if you're licensed, you can say you're licensed. And if you're not, you should say you're not.
When Clarence Thomas gets to the section where he talks about the unlicensed providers and what they need to do, he basically says California hasn't demonstrated any reason other than one that is purely hypothetical. And he says the only justification to put this forward was so that women in California could know that they could get medical care from licensed professionals. But there's nothing to suggest that women don't already know that. They know that these are already unlicensed. And so in his view, I think it's overkill.
Wow. Okay, so now the case has been returned to the lower court for further proceedings.
Yeah, the decision is to kick it back to the court and with the instructions to look at it again through this lens, looking at it as what's called a content-based regulation. That means it's going to require strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny is the highest level of judicial scrutiny, and almost always anything will fail strict scrutiny. So he's more or less saying, look at it through this new test and come to the conclusion that we think we've come to, which is that it's probably a violation of the First Amendment.
So in essence, they struck down the law today.
It's going to be really interesting to see the California courts and the Ninth Circuit try to thread the needle. It's very clear that when this got struck down, the California courts used the precedent that existed. We have decades of case law going back to the Casey decision about informed consent and what doctors can tell women about the risks around abortion. Justice Breyer said, look, they just followed all that precedent. But I think Clarence Thomas is saying we are creating some kind of new carve out here for entities that expressly exist because they don't believe in abortion. That is for religious reasons. And we are going to have to give them some kind of higher level protection that they cannot be compelled to say something that is anathema to their religious beliefs. And so it looks like it's a whole new ball of wax. It is certainly not what the Ninth Circuit applied in the lower court.
Dahlia Lithwick writes for Slate. Thank you, Dahlia.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, writer and producer Marty Noxon on her TV show Dietland, where women take up arms in the name of feminism.
I don't advocate for violence. I don't honestly think that's the right solution. But in studying revolution, there has to be the threat of violence for real lasting change.
Plus, placing homeless families in motel rooms, better than the streets, but an imperfect temporary solution to our homeless crisis? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I do not need to tell you, homelessness in our area is bad. More than 53,000 people are living on the streets in LA County. And one of the ways officials are trying to help is by moving some of these people temporarily into motels. It's a step up for sure from the streets, but these motels are often rough. Life there full of challenges. Reporter Deepa Fernandez spent much of the last few months at some of these roadside motels around the city to find out what it's like to call a motel room home.
23-year-old Sofia Diaz is cooking breakfast. It smells so good.
I'm making breakfast for the babies. I'm making them some eggs in a basket.
She cuts up the egg toast into tiny pieces for Logan, her soon-to-be one-year-old.
What we have to tell people is that this is not like a kitchen that you're in right now. No, it's not. It's a little portable heater and a little skillet, you know, a little bit of butter.
It's tucked in the corner of the motel room, and you have like a pantry set up. Tell me about it.
I have some baby food, some snacks, some herbs for tea, some
you know, spices for dinner, some cookies.
She and Logan, along with her husband, Jose Ramirez, have been here for 4 months. And as set up as this family has their tiny motel room, it's far from where they imagined their son would live during his first year of life.
We were renting our back house and we got kicked. Well, they sold the house and we had to move out November last year.
The couple had $5,000 in savings. They figured it was enough for first, last and security deposit. But the competition for affordable one bedrooms and studios was so stiff, they lost out on every apartment they applied for. While they searched, they stayed in cheap motels. And before they knew it, they'd spent down their savings on motel rooms. They ended up on the doorstep of an organization called LA Family Housing, which helps homeless families. They were placed in this ground floor room at the Palm Tree Motel in the San Fernando Valley, where they've been ever since.
My name is Ryan Izell. I'm the Chief Program Officer at Union Station Homeless Services.
Izell's organization, like LA Family Housing, meets people when they've run out of every other option for housing and are literally sleeping in a car or on the street.
We've been utilizing motels to assist families with getting off the streets, again, having a roof over their head and some stability while we pursue permanent resources.
Homeless families get a voucher to stay in a motel for a night or two, maybe a week, or at most for 28 days. This isn't new, but with county officials under intense pressure to find housing for LA's homeless population, in the past year, service providers have turned to motels more than ever.
We have quite a bit of new funding where we can now assist families with ensuring that they're off the streets.
But just having more money for motel vouchers doesn't mean motel owners want homeless families filling all their rooms. I asked Stephanie Moran, who works for LA Family Housing, about this problem. She's the one who makes the calls to motel owners when they need to place a family.
Do motel owners have stereotypes about homeless families?
In general, I think so. The ones particular that we work with have become familiar with our families and the families that we serve and just homelessness in general. So they very much so, I think, are empathetic and understanding of who we place and who we serve. But in general, I do feel that if we continue to grow at the rate that we are now and try to get motel partners, it's going to be a lot more informative and an educational experience that they will need to go through in order to understand who we're serving.
In other words, for every motel owner who agrees to accept a voucher from a homeless family, there are multiple motel owners that refuse. And that means service providers can't be too picky. The motels that do accept county vouchers can be inexpensive, some even rent by the hour. Some are poorly maintained, some are even dangerous. And while it's better than a tent on the side of the road, this definitely worries Moran.
Well, because it's not only our families that we place there. These motels are open to the general public. They can, you know, rent to a walk-in, anybody coming in. And we don't know what that activity looks like. And having children exposed to that can, you know, be very, very concerning, which is why case managers are visiting families at the motels, checking in, you know, making sure that the children are safe, the family is safe throughout their time there.
That kind of intensive case management also makes homeless families better neighbors than the motel might otherwise be, city officials say. City Attorney Mike Feuer is a big proponent of using motel rooms to house the homeless.
By the way, if one is a neighbor of many of these motels, one might think this is a higher and better use of property, which will make my community safer, cleaner, and a place where I would want my kids to grow up.
I talked to many homeless families living in motels over the last few months. While all were appreciative of the warm room with a door that locks, well, there were issues. Remember Jose Ramirez and his wife Sofia? They were sizzling eggs for their one-year-old Logan. Ramirez told me about this one scary night at the motel where they stay in North Hills.
There was one incident where we were here and there was like 6-7 officers armed around the corner, and they came in tactically and went upstairs into one of the rooms and ejected somebody. But just to have that kind of situation going on right in front where you live, especially with kids in here, not knowing if a person is armed or not armed, or, you know, just, it's crazy. It's crazy.
It's not just the violence. The motel environment can be hard for kids in other ways. Jonathan Olortegue had been living in a motel with his baby for months and says she missed crucial developmental milestones.
My daughter didn't learn how to walk till almost a year.
Because, he says, he never put her on the floor of the motel room.
Because you don't know, you know, hotels are, you know, pretty dirty and the floor, you know, people go there, you know, just to go have fun. And I didn't want my daughter, you know, touching the floor or anything. So I kept her on the bed. You know, she didn't even crawl.
And that wasn't all.
There's been times where we left the hotel at 3 a.m. because, you know, there was roaches.
Others like Nancy Perez and Sergio Zuniga told me that eating is a problem at some of the motels.
No, we can't cook at the hotel and we can't cook anywhere else. So it's just...
Where do you eat then?
Fast food every day. McDonald's, wherever, like we can, dollar menu.
Sofia Diaz says she's glad to have a motel room where she and Jose can cook. Jose was working as a chef before he was homeless, and they pick up fresh veggies and meat as much as possible. They even restarted their herb garden. And it surprises me when I open the bathroom door.
This bathroom, I can... No, it's the basil.
Yeah, we have basil growing in here. We have mint. We have aloe vera, just in case we get, like, cuts or anything like that. We usually have to wash the dishes in the sink, though. I mean...
To get around the dirty carpet issue, each day they roll out a large playmat for Logan.
You want some banana, baby?
A baby gate with brightly colored toys blocks the entrance so they can leave the motel door open and let air in. As for Ramirez...
We work magic with the things we have.
He's hoping to get back to working as a chef, if anyone out there has an opening.
Yeah, I love cooking. It's what I do. I just made her some steak last night, I mean, in a hotel, and she said it was phenomenal.
And then Logan grabs my mic.
This interview is over.
For KCRW, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
Tomorrow we'll follow one family. They were given a 28-day voucher for a motel room, a 28-day reprieve from the streets, and just 28 days to figure out how not to become homeless again. Okay, we're going to talk about homelessness and housing with someone who's going to be spending a lot of time dealing with that over the next few years. London Breed is the new mayor of San Francisco. She'll be sworn in next month. She's just 43 years old. She grew up in the city in public housing with her grandmother. She went to public school, and she's worked in government for years. She's the first African-American woman to be San Francisco's mayor. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Let us talk about this big issue, homelessness. You told the New York Times recently that you want to clear out tent encampments in your city. How would you do that?
Within my first year of taking office, we can clear out all of the tent encampments, which also provide opportunities for those who are living in these encampments, whether it's one of our shelter beds, our navigation centers, our single room occupancy hotels. Sadly, many of the people that we did encounter have challenges with addiction and with mental health issues, and those are things that we are going to need to address as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have enough places for them to go? Do you have, when you look at that combination of places you just mentioned, the shelter beds, SROs, et cetera, are there enough beds in the city for all of them?
There are not enough beds right now, today, but I do think that based on what our plans are, that there could be. Just to be clear, here in San Francisco, what I'm really proud of is the fact that we opened up a new building for 70 formerly homeless veterans. And my goal is to identify what is available and how we can start to open the doors to individuals. But the other side of that is, once someone is stabilized, once they're housed, how do we transition them into something else so that we can also have an available opportunity to someone else who sadly is experiencing mm-hmm. homelessness? And so there's a move on program.
All right. And if they refuse your offers of these other places, you say that you're still not going to tolerate this tent encampment situation anymore. So what would you do? What would happen?
We go out there to try and develop relationships to understand the situation that people are in and making it clear that we want to help you. We want to address your needs. If we provide an alternative and you refuse, we want you to know in the next couple of weeks or months, we're going to still clear out this area.
Well, meanwhile, figures show that the median home price in San Francisco is $1.6 million, double what it was just 5 years ago. And the average rent is $3,000 a month for just a one bedroom. So it seems that that's unsustainable to have a middle class, not to mention working class, in San Francisco. So how do you work on that end of it, preventing people from either leaving the city or becoming homeless?
I have a really aggressive plan around housing. Everything is going to be about building more housing faster, and building a real housing ladder for low, moderate, and middle-income residents. And we have to look at underutilized sites all over San Francisco. And we can't be afraid of an increase in density.
Do you talk to Mayor Garcetti here in Los Angeles? Because it seems that both cities have similar problems with housing production and homelessness. Oftentimes, people here in LA look to San Francisco and they think, oh, we don't want to be that because our housing prices are lower here for the time being. We may have more homeless people, but it seems that it's a more affordable city to live in for more people. But I wonder if you two talk about these problems and share solutions or share ideas.
Well, just so you know, I just got elected.
Yeah.
So I've been talking to a lot of people, including mayors all around the country. We will definitely have a working relationship to help combat a number of things that I know we both need to address. And one of those things is mental illness as well. Right now, there's a bill in the state Senate that passed out of the state Senate, 31-0, Scott Wiener's bill, SB 1045, which will give us an additional definition so that we're able to conserve individuals, which is provide them with a guardian that can make decisions for someone who clearly is mentally ill and can't make decisions for themselves.
And would you force people into that? If they're deemed sufficiently mentally ill, would you say, we are going to force you into conservatorship?
Yes. I'll give you an example. There is a person who is a senior citizen. He's a schizophrenic. He is in the Haight-Ashbury community. And sadly, every time he cashes his check, he gets robbed. He doesn't take medication. He's had situations with lice and other health issues. And he does not have anyone who's taking care of himself. He gets arrested from time to time. And he's in and out of the jail. So the jails, in essence, sadly, are being used to address his issues. And it's not helping him. It's one thing for someone who knows how to take care of themselves and make the right decisions about their life. It's another thing for someone who just completely does not have the ability to do that and just really needs what is, in essence, I think, you know, someone who is a guardian or a caretaker who could make good decisions on their behalf. And we're proposing safe injection sites, which I know, again, is another thing that's very controversial. And I truly believe that this is an opportunity to potentially get needles off the streets, to get people off the streets from shooting up publicly. But more importantly, when someone who is suffering from addiction and they're ready to get treatment, they're ready to get help, you know, having detox or treatment on demand within these facilities is going to be an important part of the equation. So I think it's something that could be really effective and help us to address the challenges that we're experiencing, not just in San Francisco, but all over the country with this opioid crisis. And I just think that we have to step outside the box if we're going to solve these issues. And I'm committed to doing just that.
San Francisco Mayor London Breed, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, showrunner Marty Noxon on how her life story informed her character's struggles with eating disorders and addiction. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so time for TV on the radio. No
one told you that was... This is serious.
Gumby, no wonder.
The actual retail price is...
Okay, we're going to talk to Marti Noxon now. She has written, produced, and directed TV shows and films for more than 20 years, just to name a few. Buffy, The Vampire Slayer, Mad Men, Grey's Anatomy, Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, Unreal. She's always written female characters as interesting, multidimensional, and with a few dark sides. But only now, it seems, in this Me Too era, is Hollywood truly catching up with her. She has created two new TV shows. One is Dietland on AMC right now. It's about women taking up arms in the name of feminism. The second one is called Sharp Objects, and it's about a journalist who investigates murders in her hometown. And she struggles with alcohol addiction. She's also into self-harm. She cuts herself, or more specifically, she carves words onto her body. Well, the show premieres on HBO in July. Marti Noxon joins me now in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
Wow, you have a lot. I can't believe you actually took time out to be here because you seem
well,
so busy.
Of course. Like, I'm a longtime listener, longtime fan.
Okay, well, let's talk about these women in your two latest series. They seem to, as I said in the intro, have a few dark sides to them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
First of all, there is Plum in Dietland. Tell us about Plum.
It's funny because I've been talking a lot about Plum, and I think in some ways she is my superhero story. She's kind of an everywoman. She is fat. She's 300 pounds, and she's lived her whole life waiting for that moment when she gets thin enough that her real life starts. Mm. And she has this vision of this person inside of her who is her real self, and when that person comes out, everything's going to be great.
And when you say every woman, that's what every woman thinks.
I kind of feel like that's what every person thinks. Mm-hmm. The more I research all this stuff, because, you know, the film I made To the Bone was about anorexia, and mm-hmm. I, you know, have struggled with eating disorders. You know, I consider myself recovered from anorexia. But, you know, it was interesting because I relapsed, with my drinking right around the time I went into, perimenopause. Mm. And so my hormones were doing similar things to what they did when I was 13, when I got sick. The first time when I got...
When you started drinking?
Well, when I got anorexic.
Oh, okay.
So it was really interesting. These two were like big moments of upheaval when my hormones were going crazy. I got really sick both times. But the second time I just picked up alcohol because I'd learned through, you know, my travels that alcohol is much faster and easier at parties mm-hmm. than yeah. anorexia. Like way more fun.
More socially acceptable.
Yeah. And everybody does it. And so I was probably depressed and didn't know that because I'm one of those people and started drinking again. And I really tried to figure out the commonalities between food disorders or disordered eating mm-hmm. and addiction just in general. And for me, they all had in common that when I'm hyper-focused on the body or altering my mind, I'm not thinking about whatever's making me sad. I'm not dealing with any of my feelings. And I realized that, like, my disordered eating and my addiction actually were like, they weren't twins, but they were sisters.
Yeah.
You know, they were really related to each other. And I got the same exact thing out of both of them, which is I'm not here. I'm elsewhere. Mm. And whatever's going on underneath is just too painful. So in order to kind of get well again, because I recognized pretty early on that I was heading down the same path, but I had to kind of write, you know, I always think about Hamilton. I had to write my way out. You know, I had to examine it, make characters that I could feel compassion for because I don't often feel it for myself. And then I had to like put them through their paces. And thus, you know, Camille and Plum were born.
Interesting. Yeah. So they both took on each one of your personal demons.
They took on different aspects.
And alcoholism in the other one.
Yeah, I mean, each you know, Plum, I think, to me, is the person who is so addicted to the idea that a body, the way her body is how her life is going to be. I was really addicted to that idea that if I got thin enough and pretty enough, that I would be considered precious. Mm-hmm. And I looked around me and it seemed like precious girls were the ones who were protected. Like, this was all illusion, but I thought they were protected. I thought men really valued them and kept them safe. You know, it's what you see in all those stories, you know, all those Disney movies where at the end, if you're just good enough and you look right and pretty enough,
you'll get the glass slipper.
Right. And then all they go is like, happily ever after.
Yeah. But did you think that men weren't going to protect you, or men were out to get you previously, or that you weren't?
I mean, my experience of coming of age was that, and even earlier than that, unfortunately, was that I was prey. I mean, I remember I'd had some bad experiences when I was very young, and you know, bad touch experiences when I was very young.
Sexually abused?
Yeah. yes. Isn't it funny? I still don't like saying the words. Mm. But the reason I waver is because I don't have all my memories. And I never want to say that something happened that didn't happen about, you know, being very, very young. I just know that I was symptomatic. Huh. And I am very, very sensitive. But I was symptomatic from a very young age and acting out in ways that
and
indicate.
Do you know who the perpetrator may have
I have
been?
Some ideas. But again, you know, I don't have all the information. And every time I get close, I shut down. So who knows? Hmm. It's one of those things that I've had to accept as a mystery. And the answer doesn't really matter. You know, it doesn't really matter. All I need to honor is that I was symptomatic, and it got way worse when I turned 12 or so and started to really develop. And then, you know, things that were undeniable started happening. You know, guy jumped out of a bush and tried to drag me in the bush and got his hand under my skirt. And a guy in a movie theater conned me and got me to sit next to him and tried to, you know, feel me up. And, you know, thing after thing after thing. And, you know, and then unfortunately later I was raped twice, both by acquaintances, wow. Separate incidents. And one time, you know, I was raped by a girlfriend's boyfriend, and I'm pretty sure we were drugged. And it was horrible. I mean, it was just horrible, horrible, horrible. And for years, I didn't think it was rape. I thought it was my fault because I got in the car with them. I took the drink, you know. Even though that night was so different than any other night I'd ever had a drink before, I was clearly not okay.
When did you realize it wasn't your fault?
Honestly, after Trump won the presidency, I started writing about how threatening it felt. And I couldn't square why people would vote, and especially women, why they would vote for somebody who had said and done, you know, such awful things. I mean, it wasn't even the stuff they couldn't prove. It was the things he was saying on the day. Mm-hmm. I was just like, but he just said these awful things about, you know, Miss Universe. Like, he just said that. So in trying to figure all that out, I realized how much I as a woman had accepted certain things to be true. That if you get in a car with a man and he drugs you and rapes you, you shouldn't have gotten in that car.
Mm. So all of these ways to excuse bad behavior,
or worse, criminal behavior,
institutionalized in our culture. And so with Dietland, the women take their revenge to the extreme, right? They kill men who
yeah.
have done this
yeah.
and dump their bodies on roads and all over the place, out of buildings.
Right. And I don't advocate, you know, I'm not an advocate for violence. I don't honestly think that's the right solution. But in studying revolution, there's almost always a violent catalyst. There has to be the threat of violence for real lasting change. And it is, once I started to unpack the ideas in the book Dietland, I was like, it is kind of amazing that women who spend so much time in their lives feeling physically threatened, that we have to do this math in our head all the time of, if I take a run at 5 o'clock and it starts to get dark, am I safe? Is my daughter safe leaving the house? Literally, it's safe from rape and or worse, right? Every day of our lives. And the fact that we have not started our own militia is kind of amazing to me. Like, as I started to really think about it, I'm like, we have really been taught not to protect ourselves. It is deeply ingrained in us that that is not our right. And so even though it's an extreme in the book, they are doing the classic revolution playbook, which is big, scary, and in your face.
So there's some pushback now with this Me Too outing of men.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as extreme, obviously. But, you know, people are saying, look, there's this rush to judgment. These careers are being ruined. There's a mob mentality.
Yeah.
When it comes to outing men who have done questionable things, and examples including the writer Junot Diaz, Aziz Ansari.
Yeah.
I mean, even Matt Weiner, whom you worked with and who was accused of making very inappropriate comments on set.
Yeah.
Which he has denied.
He has denied that. And, you know, I made a choice to, you know, one of the writers that I worked with on Mad Men stepped forward to say that something had happened to her that was, in fact, illegal, the comment that was made that was illegal. And I know that woman very well. And I remember the day. I remember the day after and how shaken she was. And the problem with so many of these things that come forward is people don't put context in it, and they don't think about the atmosphere that something might have been said. Like, the comment may be seemingly innocuous, but when you start to put context around it, and actually in the Twitter storm that I dropped to respond and say that I supported her and I believed her, was trying to put it in context. Like, we were all in fear for our jobs every day. And we did, you know, Matt has a big personality. And when people would leave, you know, he would say awful things about them. And so all of us thought it could be the end of a career we'd worked so hard for. And like, I was in a situation where I was heading toward divorce, and I knew that, you know, I might end up supporting my whole family. People assume that we all have safety nets, that we all have places to land. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that kills me is this comment, well, you know, why don't you just quit? I'm like, do you know how hard it was to get where I'm a woman in this business. Do you know how hard it was to get here in the first place? And now you're telling me to just quit. You assume that there's something else for me other than a waitressing job. Like, would you just quit? Like, I always want to turn to the guy who says that to me and say, oh, would you just throw away everything you'd always worked for, or would you try to tolerate it another day?
So I'm wondering, with these two shows, which are pretty radical in how they portray women and their desires and their unhappiness. Both of these women are deeply, deeply unhappy, and that in itself is radical, is to portray a woman as deeply unhappy.
Yeah.
If you got pushback from the networks to make your characters happier or more likable?
No, at all. I think that there was only, especially particularly on Dietland, the push to move the story forward to where she is more activated. Because it really, for the first season of Dietland, almost is a superhero origin story. Like, she starts to realize that her life experience and being a fat person is a superpower. And she starts to recognize that her anger and her intellect are a superpower. But the first four episodes are about getting to that aha moment where she goes, oh, I have superpowers.
Marty, we could have talked all day. I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Marty Noxon, TV writer and producer. Her show Dietland is on AMC now. Sharp Objects premieres on HBO on July 8th. Christian Bordahl is here now with some World Cup news.
Sure, yes. The huge games today, because Argentina went into today knowing that if they had lost or even tied against Nigeria, they were out of the cup.
Should we say spoiler alerts for people taping?
We should say spoiler alerts.
La, 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 la.
The great Lionel Messi would have been done and out of the World Cup. It was such an exciting game. All I'll say is that in the 86th minute, Argentina scores and they are through, and really worth watching.
Okay, great. Thank you, Christian Bordahl, resident Norwegian. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.